But yeah, everyone that's worked with me has heard me say the, you know, we're not selling shoes line, just from being in a bunch of these marketing meetings where it's like very technical speak about why the numbers aren't this and why the numbers aren't that. It's like a lot of times it's very easy answer. It's like Big Papa Gates went to France for 2 weeks.
Hey, what's up, everybody? GP13 here, joined with one of my very good friends, Dylan, who has been posting a lot of great content on social media that's been more from a business of sports betting standpoint, which I find really interesting. But yeah, Dylan, welcome to the show. Welcome. I've been trying to get you on here for a long, long time. How does it feel?
It feels great. This is my first on-air performance. I recently played piano in front of people for the first time at NBA All-Star Weekend. And so it feels like I'm coming out of my shell and, you know, being on camera. This is just the place that I knew I would end up in. No, I'm kidding. Never thought I'd be on here, but this is awesome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, we met a while ago, just via Twitter, which is how I now meet all my friends. And we had a call, and I think we clicked pretty quickly. And people might be surprised by that because we do kind of sit on different sides of the counter, right?
Yeah, I mean, people that know me personally and that have been around me for the last 10 years know that I say like I'm an ally of the sharps. I mean, when I started at FanDuel back in the day, most of the biggest daily fantasy sports players are now either sharp bettors or they're still pretty sharp guys in the fantasy world. And so those were my initial interactions. I didn't really get into whales or losing players until much later, until sports betting. So yeah, I would say we can get more into it, but the VIP teams and the customer facing teams in the industry are generally aligned with the sharps. They're not incentivized to limit you. They're not the ones that are like flagging sharp accounts and hitting up trading. It's the reverse. And I know we'll talk about that.
Yeah. And I think that's good intro. So yeah, Dylan, you know, OG of the sports betting space, you know, one of the first, 12, 20 people at FanDuel.
Yep.
You've kind of seen a lot of different roles and, you've seen both FanDuel and DraftKings and, you know, you've been really involved in the space. But if you want to give everybody just a quick rundown of how you got into the industry, where you've been, and then we can get to the juicy stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I'll give the good intro. So I started passing out March Madness brackets in probably sixth grade, collecting cash. And that was my intro into sports gambling. One of the claim to fames of that middle school run is that the now woman, who won 2 out of 3 years in middle school, she's now one of the highest ranking executives in the MLB, wow. Which is pretty crazy. So maybe March Madness brackets is a game of skill. I don't know. You can tell me. I kept gambling throughout high school, got into poker with the Chris Moneymaker thing, like everyone in our generation. Started playing daily fantasy early. So I was the 1,000th sign up on FanDuel. We learned that once I started at FanDuel. I didn't really know what to do after college. I went to Maryland. I was doing basketball training stuff. I kind of thought I'd end up being like a PE teacher, basketball coach type of guy. And then one of my very smart business friends said, why don't you just go work for FanDuel? You've been playing on there forever. So in 2013, I reached out to someone on LinkedIn and asked them for a job. They told me to come up to New York. So I did. They signed me to like a 4-month customer support rep contract in 2014. I took it. I lived on my buddy's couch for what ended up being a couple years as a customer support rep at FanDuel. So that was from 2014 to 2016. If you guys are OG fantasy players, you'll remember like the site would crash on Sundays and there was all this pending bonus drama with all the advertisements. So I was the one answering all those emails, answering all the live chats, which was, you know, a great time. And honestly, the best foundation I could have asked for what became of my career. So I was at FanDuel for 4 years. I became one of the first VIP hosts when they started the VIP team, managing the biggest players. And then when sports betting legalized, my life changed. All of a sudden, this became a billion, multi-billion dollar business that I was a part of and had some good connections. So I built the VIP team at William Hill from scratch when sports betting legalized. And then a year later, went to DraftKings where I ran the VIP acquisition and growth team for 4 years.
Damn, that's a pretty epic career, man. Dude, you've seen it. I think seeing FanDuel from those days, it must have been crazy, the transformation between when you started and when you went to William Hill. Like, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, it was insane. When I think back to when I started, we were in a little WeWork in Union Square. There was probably 15, 20 of us in a tiny room. You know, myself and the other couple customer support reps and Nigel Eccles, the founder and godfather of Daily Fantasy in the same room. And everybody loved fantasy. It was just a bunch of people like us, you know, a mix of sharp individuals and just gamblers like me who lose money. But it was fun. There was so much passion in it. And then 4 years later, when FanDuel became a super big business, that's when some outside executives from the tech world and the business world started coming in. And, you know, it changed the vibe. I don't know if it's better or worse. It just made it a little bit more legitimate and corporate and different. It wasn't all gambling people. It's now a lot of business people and some gambling people that work at these operators. So I think that was the biggest change.
And what I've always wondered this. So like I am a gambler who went to business school. So I did like my semester abroad in business and came back to gambling. Right. But what did the business people, what are they missing when they come in? Because I found that, it's a lot. Like it's just a lot.
One thing that I remember, that's a perfect question for a great story that I have. We were probably in the second FanDuel office. There was maybe 100 people at the company at the time. I think I probably had just started on the VIP team. So we were looking at a list of the biggest daily fantasy players on FanDuel. So this must have been 2016. We have our couple hundred top players, and it's a mix of sharps that are up tons of money. It's the usernames that everybody recognizes, Big Papa Gates, Chipotle Addict, Condia back then. And then at the bottom was all the biggest losing players. And as a gambler and someone that started in poker, you know, like for the ecosystem to exist long term, those losing players really matter. Ideally, they have tons of money and they're doing this for fun. And a lot of those players lose a bunch of money and then they stop playing because either they go broke or they lose their bankroll. And I remember we had a new C-level executive who's awesome now and has learned a ton about the industry. There's no way he remembers this, but he took a look at my screen and he basically looked at me. He's like, why the fuck are these people not continuing to play? Like, he was shocked that the losing players stopped playing. And so I was like, oh, it's almost, they aren't almost looking at it like it's funny money. Like, it's not someone's real wallet. And so I explained, it's like, well, these people churn, right? Someone that loses 500 grand in a year probably isn't going to be able to do that for the next 20 years. So you have to go acquire new big players. And so that was one of the things that was missing early. And kind of still exists where the execs are pretty far removed from the customer facing stuff. So they're not interacting as much with the biggest losing players or the sharp gamblers. And so maybe they're missing, you know, some of that aspect where like you actually could lose a lot of money here and stop playing. They're not just going to be a customer for life.
No, that's, it's like, I don't know. You ask like, oh, would you keep losing 500,000 a year, like of your money? To, you know, I think it's a problem. Like you said, it's like removed from the customer, whether I've almost thought like, and maybe it's self-serving, but the sharps are closer to the big losing players than the executives are. So I think there's more of an understanding between the sharps and the big losers. And the customer pool as a whole, I don't think it's as segmented. I mean, it's segmented skill-wise, but I don't think in terms of understanding each other, it is that segmented. But I do think there's a huge gap in understanding between the other side of the counter at the executive level and the customers, which seems to be true with what you're saying.
100%. And like there are some, you know, VPs and up that really do know the industry and their whether that they were gamblers before getting into it or they've actually taken the time to talk to customers and learn. So I don't want to make it a complete 100% blanket, but generally that's right. And I would say as someone that, you know, would have been considered a big whale, like, I know what sharps are doing. I have relationships with sharp players. I was still losing money. And that's similar to a lot of the biggest players. Like, they know what CLV stands for. They know that they can beard if they want to, and they're choosing to play their own picks because that's what's more fun. That's what's more exciting. That's what's giving them the rush and the entertainment. But obviously, like, I think there are many of them that are paying attention to Twitter and the sharp scene and know what's going on. They're just kind of choosing to stay out of it. I'll also say some of the biggest players that where there's tickets posted on Twitter of like six figure bets, mm-hmm. the sharp community tends to jump on it and say like, these guys must be idiots. Not all of them are idiots. There are a lot of these dudes that are like losing at maybe 1% or less than 1%. And they're allowed to continue betting really big because it's either good for marketing or, you know, they're going to break even or lose a little, but they're not, these guys aren't losing at like 20, 30% in the way that these single game parlay dudes are.
Interesting. That is interesting. Is there ever a consideration where you would allow somebody to bet? Like, let's say I've suddenly grown my Twitter following to 100,000 people and FanDuel is like, hey, if you post tickets, like we will take like a reasonable size here. Like would that ever happen? I don't know if you can even know answer to that, but I'm
so
curious.
It would definitely depend on like whoever's the leader and being able to make that decision. So some C-level exec at a company, but me personally, I think that's a good idea. And this brings me to something else I would love to talk about. Like I met Spanky in 2019. And recently he called me a punk ass bitch, which I loved.
Oh yeah, we can get into that.
I loved it. You might be bringing it up. But anyways, at that time I met him, you know, we had a couple beers, we hit it off. I was just starting at DK and I thought along the lines of what you're saying, which is let's let this dude bet. He's going to say good things about us on Twitter. At the time he was one of the, and still one of the like biggest and best personalities online. And so I fought to get his account open because of what you're saying. And they didn't really go for it. So I think it probably depends on who's making the decision, who the person on social media is. The companies are never going to reach out to you first and make that offer.
Right.
But yeah, if someone's bringing marketing value or they play a bunch of casino or they refer a lot of people, it's definitely open for discussion, depending on the book. I'm sure some books just only will go by what the traders say and others will actually take this stuff into consideration.
That's so, you know, what's funny is like, I always got the most out of podcasts I've listened to where I've listened to somebody like you, someone on that side of the counter. Like I learn a lot from Spanky and from Circles Off. And, you know, I hope people learn from the past guests I've had on here who are betters, but I really think that you have the most valuable stuff is like putting yourself in the shoes of the sportsbook, and the sportsbook isn't just a trader, right? It's a marketing team. It's a, you know, executives that have certain metrics that they may want to be hitting or not. Yeah. And that's the sportsbook. So if you're referring people, maybe that helps. I don't know. You know, shout out FanDuel, you know, if you want to come on here and, you know, let me refer people so I can bet huge on golf. Like, well, you know, I'm down, but, I really like, I'm curious to hear more about this because I think people will get a lot from it. So when you were approaching DraftKings about the Spanky proposition, they basically like, we know DraftKings is more on the side of recreational, you know, that's not news, you know, they're going to limit people. So it would have been a big ask, but I'm curious, like what, if you can give us more details on that conversation, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, it never got super far where it was like a massive conversation. I remember bringing it to the table and I don't think these people aren't on gambling Twitter. So like they don't know who Spanky is in relation to the community. And my thought was you don't want to be known as the book that limits everybody because then what happens is losing gamblers assume that if they hit a 12-leg parlay, they're not going to get paid out. And it's like this big jump to conclusions where all the time we'd be at events or we'd be meeting people, you know, clearly not professional gamblers. And they'd say, I hear if I win money, I'm going to get cut off. Whether at every book you hear that. And it's a little overblown in our community because so many of you guys are probably limited, but like the actual percentage is very low. Our mistakes made, I'm sure. But there are plenty of VIPs who win 6-7 figures and it's fine. But yeah, I think in that conversation, it was just like the value that I thought we would get from Spanky being kind of an ambassador for us, they just didn't see as much. And maybe they're right. I don't know. We'll never know.
Yeah. It is tricky. Cause like, what do you give them? These are unlimited. Like if you gave me a DraftKings account that you told me could never be limited, you know, I'd make, you know, millions of dollars in a year.
Yeah. You'd have to cap the bet size.
So there has to be some negotiation, but it is interesting. It's an interesting thought. And, you know, I'd love to hear about those get-togethers when you talk with, you know, recreational gamblers. Like they're there, they're thinking, oh, I might get limited or whatnot. But like, what are they looking for for a product, and like what interests them? You know, we talk a lot about sharps. I'd love to hear, you know, more from the recreational side.
Yeah, I think most rec players don't really know why. Most people in general don't know why sharps get limited. They think it's just wins and losses. We both know that's not true. And so I think that is what confuses them at times when they see the stories on Twitter or they see the big names complaining about being limited. So they're just looking for a place that they can get money in and out as quick as possible. So like deposits and withdrawals are mm-hmm. huge. I think now all the books are getting better at that. So there's a bit more parity there. But in the beginning, like FanDuel and DraftKings had such a big edge because if you just want to deposit $5,000 quickly, you could do so on FanDuel and DraftKings and you could get it out so quickly. Now you can pretty much do that everywhere. But when you get to like 6-7 figure deposits, there's still those wire processes that could take a long time. And I've battled with payment teams forever on like getting in wires or getting out wires quick enough for people to receive their money. So payments is definitely one. I'd say rewards is, you know, clearly two in my opinion, as long as the product is good enough. And so there's not as big deposit bonus that exists now, but in the early days of legalization, I mean, we were giving out 100% bonuses, 50% bonuses on really big deposits. And then we got burned by you and all your minions and that had to go away. But there was a time when if you just got connected to a VIP rep at any company, you were going to get hooked up in a good way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, my only comment would be thank you. Shout out DraftKings VIP team.
Yeah.
I didn't hear you mention price, which makes a lot of sense because everybody in Sharp Twitter wants to complain about hold percentage and whatnot, but it seems like it's almost not brought up on the, in our, you know, our brethren who are more recreational.
It has basically never once been brought up. if it is brought up, it's like a super red flag because it's just never brought up. So it's like, I think Sharps got smart enough to not bring it up. So you almost never hear it from anyone now. But yeah, if someone's like sending an email, you know, bitching about -108 against -110, you're probably not going to give them any sort of bonus because that's going to cause a flag. But yeah, I mean, what's way more important than price are those other aspects, payments, rewards, having a relationship with your VIP person, and the product being, you know, fast and capable. I still think there's a pretty big difference between FanDuel, DraftKings product and everyone else. I'd expect like Underdog to probably be close to them just given what they've built so far. But, everyone else seems to be in either second place or battling for third.
So I want to, before we go like deeper into the VIP stuff, which I think is going to be very interesting, I do want to talk about what you said about DraftKings VIP, early days of legalization, you know, bonus atmosphere. And it was great for the VIP program. Basically, DraftKings had a email address that you could just email and say you wanted to deposit a lot of money. And then you would just get a huge deposit bonus. And then, you know, depending, I don't even think I was relatively, clever at the time. So like I ran my welcome pretty quickly, but I think I got like a 20 grand deposit bonus. And if I have my sheet, like probably got like 30K worth of VIP money from DraftKings before getting the boot. And you said that, you know, that type of behavior kind of led to the nerfing of the program. Was there like a big, realization that, you know, they're limiting too many, there's too many sharps coming in through the VIP program?
Yeah, I think for those type of bonuses, it's hard for me to differentiate like whether it was sharps or bonus abusers or like, it was just a mixture of all of that. It was just, or people hitting and running who probably weren't even sharp. Just the math doesn't make sense when you're giving out that big deposit bonuses to everybody. It's great when you can use it to acquire, you know, the real heavy hitters that have $10 million in their bank account and can lose $500,000 a year easily. But that's a rare thing. And you have to figure out ways to find them without giving away these types of bonuses. So yeah, I think there was a point where we had like a public facing offer up to a 20K deposit. And you figure like, oh, someone's only going to be able to put on 20K if they're a pro gambler, which is like not many people, or right. if it's a VIP, a true VIP. I don't think the companies, because I don't want to limit this to just DK. I don't think the companies at the time assumed that there was going to be this much sharing of information and the forums on Reddit and Discord and Twitter. Like, I don't think they realized the social nature of the gambling world, not just sharp world. And so I think that's what ended up happening. And there's been promos since then across the industry that get pretty hard for the same reason. And I think the books are smartening up a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, all time worst promo, I think, was Caesars when they came to New York and they gave away $3,000 for free.
Yeah, exactly. And they were like number one or two in market share in the beginning. And everyone was, you know, oh, Caesars is crushing it in New York. Meanwhile, I remember that because for new state launches, that was a huge part of my job. And like we were prepared and ready to talk to high net worth individuals in the state. And everyone was playing on Caesars just to get that offer. And then as soon as they would either lose it or hit and run, they would come over to DraftKings or FanDuel. That was an interesting state launch for sure.
So has this colored your opinion on how effective bonuses are as marketing dollars?
Ooh, great question. It's still the thing that works the best. So like, you can put out a bet X get, well, I think I might've made a post about it, but if you put out, you know, for every $500 you bet, you get 10 bucks back. Like that might appeal to you because you know the math, but a random whale is going to see that. Even if you said it was, you know, 5K and getting 100 bucks back, like that does not move the needle for anyone. So you could try that all day. You're not going to acquire any good players from it. You almost have to do either deposit bonuses or experiences in hospitality, or just have like, what I always say is if you meet someone in person or if you get on the phone with someone, like a lot of times these players don't know that a VIP host exists on the digital side. So if you're a 50-year-old businessman that's been gambling your whole life, flying out to Vegas with your casino host, you don't know that you can talk to someone at one of these companies that's going to be your guy. And so a lot of times it just takes them to meet you or to know that you exist, and you don't even need to give them a bonus. But yeah, I mean, deposit bonuses work the best. It's just you got to keep it under like 20%.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've always wondered because it's, you know, it's expensive. Like it's an expensive way to acquire customers. When you talk about, you know, deposit bonuses as a percentage that can get up to, you know, 20 grand more. I'm sure like the real VIPs could get way, way more, but yeah, it's just like, it seems like it's just like a blood sport out there between all the players, like all the big players in the market trying to get customers.
Yeah. In the early days, it was like that where you'd have a big player get a percentage offer from one book, and then they would hit up all the other books with that offer. Sometimes like actually forwarding you the email, or other times, you know, playing hardball. It's like became this negotiation thing that probably shouldn't exist in the industry. Maybe at the very top, like you know, but this was somebody would send over a 50% offer and say, I'll put the money on you guys if you give me 60%. And it's like, right. How do you even, you don't know the quality of the player other than what they're telling you, which could be real or not real. It's so they're really hard decisions to make when it was a free for all. We call it like the wild, wild west kind of. But yeah, like I said, I think over the last year, year and a half, it's started to simmer down a bit and you're not seeing that as much. Still just as competitive, but you're not seeing the like, you know, negotiating tactics as if we're, you know, at like an auction or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually do remember negotiating a couple of deposit bonuses and whatnot. You know, you got to, those are high leverage spots. You know, you got to try and get an extra $5,000 there. Put in an extra hour of work, get five extra grand. That's a sick hourly, right? So like that was a crazy time. I agree with you. It seems to be dying down. I don't know if that's because bonuses have become like less a part of my strategy or not, but you know, it's a natural cycle of the industry. Like you can't just burn cash like that forever. I know investors were, clamoring for some positive EBITDA numbers eventually from the big players, in which, you know, it seems like DraftKings has finally delivered on that. But yeah, let's talk VIP. I think VIP has been one of the hottest topics of the last month. Certainly a big part of it was that Washington Post article, which I know you commented on. I've commented on briefly, but I'd love to hear your thoughts. Like maybe let's start with the article because that's kind of brought either that or Spanky calling you a little bitch or whatever he called you. When you said that you said something like be nice to customer support. And then you tagged a lot of us. And I guess Spanky didn't remember you.
He definitely did not remember me because anyone that knows me knows that I was like it was facetious and I tagged you, right?
100%. Yeah. I was like, I knew you were joking. I think he tagged me and Osimo, maybe yeah. Peter Jennings, and then Spanky and Jack, who didn't seem to want to be tagged.
Yeah. So the two guys who don't know me personally, like took it seriously. I don't think I've ever met Captain Jack at all. Seems like a fine guy. I've followed him forever. I like his content.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Spanky calling me a punk ass bitch. I mean, maybe he's right. He probably is right. There's some people that may agree, but it was great. Like when that happened, I just started tweeting a few months ago, like trying to put myself out there. You remember when I started. And I was nervous about putting out content. And when he did that, I was like, oh, I'm here. Like that was my moment. Yeah. I was so fired up that he did that. And I knew he didn't remember me. And
I'm here.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm him. But we buried the hatchet, I think. Spanky's awesome. I loved him on this podcast and he's great. But yeah, that was that topic. Like I was a customer support rep for 4 years.
Right.
I'm very defensive of customer support people. When my mom raises her voice at a McDonald's drive-thru, I get like so cringe and upset and I always defend them.
Yep.
So yeah, that's all I was saying. It seemed pretty obvious to me. I also get his point of view. Like he's a professional gambler and he's going to say and do anything he can to make an extra buck, and that's why he's been so successful. And maybe that's why I'm not a professional gambler. I don't know if I have the stomach for that. I'm just trying to be a nice guy, make friends, and have some fun.
Yeah. I mean, the tweet was something about basically being nice to customer service, and I think like Jack said something about he felt like you were targeting sharps, but I think you were just tagging people who had voices or whatnot.
Yeah, the comment was that sharp, like if you get limited, you don't need to go crazy at customer support because they have no.
And I agree.
Yeah, they don't even know what it means most of the time, and but it also goes to losing players that bitch at support over 20, not getting a $25 free bet or or a refund or their tennis player retires and they didn't like the rule. Like the customer support rep in all of these scenarios just has absolutely zero to do with any of it. So that's all I was saying. But yeah, I thought it would be funny to tag some of you guys that are sharps that I know or know of in their cases.
Yeah. And I agree with obviously I agree with you. That is not a hot take.
Yeah.
Like but what I think is like I always think, oh, why where's the upside? There's no upside. Like if you get limited and you're like, ah, I got limited. Like this is America. You think the customer service is going to be like, you know what? You're right. I'm going to march into Jason Robbins' office right now. And I'm going to demand that this person, this steam chaser, gets unlimited. So he can bet first half, small conference college basketball. You know, it's just not going to happen.
One of the best I ever had, because I would end up having conversations with sharps who would be in the VIP program or come through my team on the acquisition side and get limited. And a lot of times, if you're new to the industry, you don't know how to have that conversation with one of these guys. So I would get on the phone, and that brought up a memory. There's this guy betting like NHL player props or NHL quarters or periods. Sorry, periods. NHL periods. And he was just going nuts at me, like claiming that he has no clue what he's doing and he's just shooting darts. And it's like, come on, man. No one shoots darts doing what you're doing. But yeah, those conversations happen. And there are times that a customer facing person does fight for someone who gets limited. There's a book I know of that limited two really, really big players who are like two of the best players at another book. And you know, one of them was because they took advantage of a palp. Another one was because maybe they were bearding for someone, but then they were also putting in their own stuff. And so mistakes definitely happen. And there were times that a VIP rep that's knowledgeable and thinks they really know the player will vouch and fight. But if it's obvious that you're actually sharp, then like, yeah, the customer facing person is just as bummed as you because they want you to play, but they're not going to go to war with the trading team and C-level guys.
These two, you've told me about these two VIPs. Now these are people who are betting millions.
In total handle, yeah. So these are guys betting.
They're limited.
Yeah, they're limited. They were betting, you know, 10. And this was 4 or 5 years ago. I'm not going to say which book limited them, but yeah, like one of them took advantage of a palp and then got limited and then lost, you know, seven figures. And another one was betting 10, 20 grand a game on college basketball, bearding for someone clearly, but then he was just, you know, overnighting Chinese basketball, which is right up my alley. So I don't hate it.
It seems almost disorganized because you're going to like, or not P&L focused, because if someone hits a palp, okay, like we all know people get mad, traders get mad when people hit palps. Okay. Yeah. But okay, what if the guy who's down $1 million hits a palp? Like you can't.
Exactly.
Check your ego at the door for half a second.
Yeah. I think that most of the books now would have a more nuanced approach to getting hit on palps by a big player like that. But yeah, at the time it's like no one knew what was going on. And a lot of the people that were deep in the industry, maybe like myself, like we didn't have the power 5 years ago to make that type of call. And so when a trader from Europe gets pissed that some guy hits a palp for $3,000, they're just going to cut their account at the time. I think now it's probably more nuanced and maybe they'd have a conversation with a VP or an SVP that can override it and say like, let's see this through a little bit.
Perfect way to segue to the other side of the counter, because I'm sure that player had a VIP rep who was pissed as fuck. And probably rightfully so. But let's talk VIP program. So you started William Hill, you worked VIP at DraftKings. We don't have to, you know, get so specific that certain people get pissed. But you want to, I guess, walk us through what a VIP program is, and then we can dive into like the more recent controversy.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I would think of it like a casino host in Vegas. It's just, this is all digital. So the key was like, how do we take that approach to hospitality, entertainment, that one-to-one service, and make it work in a digital world? So a lot of it, you know, there's the account management side, which is synonymous with casino host. So that would be your VIP host. And they're responsible for basically your personal customer support rep, You know, you can text, call anytime with issues. They're making sure deposits, withdrawals go through smoothly. Any issues you have with the app, they're gonna run up on it. And then they're also the person that's responsible for giving you those one-to-one rewards that are outside of whatever loyalty program exists on the site, and making sure that you have a good relationship. They're also responsible for monitoring responsible gambling issues. I think right now there's too much responsibility on these individuals and on the operators in general to monitor that, but it is part of the job. And a really good VIP program from an account management standpoint is building awesome relationships with the players. They're making sure it's entertaining. And if responsible gambling concerns come up, they're flagging it immediately. And I think for the most part that happens, but obviously like in that article, some things fall through the cracks. But yeah, that's the account management side. And then, you know, there is some acquisition side where you're like hunting for whales. People thought my name was Hunter when I started at DraftKings. It's not, but yeah, you're really out networking, trying to meet, you know, wealthy individuals that can afford it, that are probably playing with bookies. They probably have massive credit lines, and you're trying to show them a better time, on the app that you're working for. So there's that acquisition side. And then there's like the account management side.
Got it. So it's you and Sharps both hunting for whales.
Yeah.
Either the Sharps exactly want to flip them, and you know, you want them to play.
Yeah. And
the Sharp flips them right into the VIP room.
Yeah, exactly. Someone weird said industry. The other day, I forget who it was, they commented on one of my tweets about who's that Pisky guy?
I've seen him.
Yeah, and he seems really smart. But, and he commented about like, why wouldn't these guys want a beer, basically. And I just think that from knowing a lot of these people and being one before, not everyone's flippable. Not everyone wants to give up their accounts. There are truly many, many people that have so much money and they just want to bet for fun, and they are losing players. They know they're losing players, but they also know they can get hot and win a bunch of money, and that feels great. And there's nothing a Sharp is going to say to them, you know, that's going to convince them to collect 3% until the account gets limited in 4 months. Like, they just want to bet for the next 30 years, and that's just the psyche of a big losing gambler.
Totally. And it's something like I've seen in poker. I think like sometimes we're, as a Sharp community, like such huge dorks. We're like, why wouldn't they want 3%? They're sacrificing EV. Like, yeah. And it's just like, you can't, sometimes I'll tell people, you know, like, don't do XYZ. And they're like, literally can't do it because it technically sacrifices EV. I'm like, the long term, it's so value, but they can't even sacrifice a smidge of EV. So how are they ever going to relate to a whale? Like, you're not. Don't be such a dork. That's my advice for like, if you're trying to get accounts with normal people, like, you got to be somewhat relatable. But yeah, I mean, I agree with you. And I think, so you mentioned it, like, you were in their shoes, like, you had, you know, some gambling losses, and you know what CLV is. And if you and I sat together for an hour, you would have a strategy that would win, and you know that, but like, you also,
it's not fun. Like, that's the best way to, and you know, this is where you do get into the spectrum of responsible gambling stuff, but the psyche of someone that just wants to fire away, it's like, give me courtside tickets so I can bet on that game. Mm-hmm. And that is the most exciting part of it. The exciting part isn't, whereas like, to you, the exciting part may actually be figuring out the puzzle of beating the books and figuring out the puzzle of, you know, how to get my plays in, how to get accounts, I can see why Sharp people can't imagine thinking the other way, but like, just know that the people that are firing away and losing, like, they're not that, the ones that are doing it comfortably aren't that mad about it. And yeah, it's just not that serious to them to try to figure out this puzzle. It's entertainment. They're looking at it like you look, you know, like going out to dinner probably.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's the comp you hear. It's like, oh, if you spend, you bet $100 on a game, or you go to a movie, betting $100 on the game's cheaper because you spend $10 at EV or whatever. Not that we're, you know, that's not maybe the language we're talking from. the entertainment standpoint, but you know, it checks out. And I think there's obviously a use case for it. And the tricky part and the part like I had trouble with in poker is that what if, you know, if I was playing and I felt like I took a pot off somebody who then I really didn't think could afford to lose it. Then I was like, oh fuck. But you know, I still play the game, right? Like
yep.
I'm still playing poker, and when you're at the table, you make, you know, the decisions to maximize your dollars won, or else, you know, you're fucked. But you know, it's definitely crossed my mind on almost every day. It's like, well, how many of the people who are big donators in the poker community can afford it? And I mean, that even goes to someone like Guy, who donated to the top online pros for years. It's like, I don't know. Like, can he even afford it now? You know, I haven't heard much from him. So, you know, now we're getting into that article, and we'll talk about the article. So it's basically Washington Post.
Wall Street Journal.
Wall Street Journal. There is a woman who was actually, she was like a doctor of psychology or a therapist. Yeah. So this is crazy to begin with, because it's just like the story, it's compelling because this is someone who's trained to think about, you know, the deficiencies in human psychology, which is the thing that that gambling plays on. And even she, or especially she, just completely helpless at the feet, in the hands of what becomes a pretty serious gambling addiction. And she was in some VIP programs, and a big part of the article was discourse between her and her hosts. And of course, the Wall Street Journal is going to cherry pick stuff that's interesting, that is controversial, right? But like the conversations were kind of damning, where she was indicating she couldn't really afford to do this, and she would get like more promotions or something. So yep. When that came out, it put VIP programs in the Twitter discourse, at least. And I know you posted about it, but I'd love to hear just like your general thoughts. Then we can dive further into it.
Yeah. I mean, first off, it was a bad interaction by the VIP host. Like that's just a clear flag. You raise it to the responsible gambling people, you know, and then they reach out and take care of it. Most likely, you know, either suspend the account or ban the account permanently. So it was an indefensible response and reaction. But that's also back to my point of like, you're putting so much onus on someone who, I'm not saying this person in particular, but like there are cases where you hire a VIP host straight from, you know, some account management role at Oracle or something. They say that they're a gambler, but they've never dealt with gambling addiction in their lives. Maybe they've never even dealt with any type of addiction in their lives. And so it's like, you can do all the training you want, but when you get in that moment, it is hard to go against the customer's wishes when you like, they're trying to do something and play, and it's your responsibility to cut it off. So it's tough. It still should have been done in that situation. But it's hard that all the onus falls on that person or on the operators, when the job of DraftKings is to make money and to make profit. So like, I do think hopefully there's some third party approach that is the winning solution. There's never going to be anything perfect when it comes to addiction. Clearly in this case, given the customer's background, like anyone's susceptible to this. I've noticed that in my life, you know, whether that's gambling, drugs, alcohol, social media, like anyone's susceptible to this. It's just going to be a tough, tough solve if we're relying on the operator to catch it all the time. But this was a bad interaction. And like, this was an obvious one that most of the time is flagged, sent over to the RG team and taken care of.
Yeah, for sure. And I actually think that the discourse around that this article brought up went way beyond VIP programs and into, like you said, where does the buck stop? Where does the responsibility fall to define what a problem gambler is? Because that's that's tough. There's accounts, like I've had accounts go down, you know, 70, 80K pretty quick. So someone could be like, he's a problem gambler. Like where in, you know, the grand scheme of things, some of my accounts are way up, but like that one account, that's the only thing that operator sees. You know, how do they know that I'm not, you know, a sharp bettor is not a problem?
Yep. Gambler. And look, at the end of the day, a person that really wants to gamble is going to gamble. So like you can get limited or get your accounts banned. If someone wants to go get a credit account, they can, and that's even more dangerous. So I think that like legal sports betting is good. There should be better, hopefully, protections, and maybe that'll be some third party. I know Underdog was investing in some stuff that the sharps got mad about.
We should talk about that actually.
But I at least think the idea is right that it should be a third party and not necessarily the operator. But yeah, it's so hard to identify. I mean, I've had clients when I was a host that can lose millions of dollars and be totally comfortable. And I know for a fact they have, you know, nine figures in their bank account. And then you have other guys that lose $1 million and you don't really know their situation. Like some are honest with you, some aren't. You collect their bank statements initially, but you don't know what other accounts they have or what other debts they may have. So it's a really, really tough problem. Haralabob just tweeted about it, which his tweet kind of blew up outside of our, you know, sharp gambling. I'm not part of sharp gambling Twitter. Let's be honest. I'm just.
I think you are. You're actually the bridge.
I'm the bridge.
I think a lot of I think most of your followers are actually sharp. But your content's really good. I mean, your content's thoughtful. So, you know,
one other point
on
that.
Not picks. Yeah, please.
Yeah. One other point on that is I said this too, that I think there's just from being around gambling addiction a while, there's a difference between gambling addict and problem gambler. And the first one is not as bad as the second one, in my opinion. The first one, it may be someone that's doing it as an escape to get away from their anxiety. They're doing it every day. They're talking about it with their friends. But it's not a problem in the sense that it's not hurting their bank account. So like I have friends that make, you know, high six figures a year and they're betting $100 a game every day. And, you know, at the end of the year, they're going to win or lose a few grand and it just doesn't affect them. You could say that they're a gambling addict, but that's not someone that you would suspend their account for because they're not losing all their money. And so it's just so hard to know which people are the ones that are actually losing all their money, where it's having a financial impact on their lives. And at the end of the day, like I said, even if the books do everything properly, regulators get involved, you can still just go to a credit account, which is, you know, a problem in and of itself. Obviously, for sharps, it's good that they exist, but for the responsible gambling conversation, it's not great.
Yeah, I think, I mean, shout out to my credit accounts. I love them. But, you know, I do think that they're terrible, terrible for problem gamblers. It's so bad because it's like, you know, if you read through that Wall Street Journal article, imagine if the main character, if she had a credit account, like she was betting on shore, but it's like, I mean, she would obviously dust through it. She couldn't stop betting, you know, when she needed to. Like, who's going to say you stop at zero? And that's where credit accounts like bury people, which are problematic. And there's no one's going to go to the offshores and be like, you need to have more responsible gambling because they're just, you know, in an office in Costa Rica and no one can kind of talk to them. And like you said, the problem's going to, as long as that's an option, the problem exists. Like it doesn't.
Yep.
It doesn't go away.
And so, it's like, I think the conversation is good that it's happening now. Like I've seen some other posts about Australia and different countries in Europe where legal gambling has existed for longer. And some of the studies up, you know, where it's like their economy didn't collapse. It ends up, there's like ebbs and flows in the discourse around this. But yeah, I think it's inevitable and good that the conversation's happening now before, you know, some crazy storm of negative events happens. But yeah, like people are going to figure out how the regulated industry in the US wants to attack it. Are there going to be limits on what type of marketing campaigns people can use? Are there going to be bet limits? Like that wouldn't be great. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it shakes out. Well, yeah, especially with all the money on the line.
The bet limits won't work. I think that's pretty obvious. From like, I think all the people, even if it's like men, like betting men limits, like that won't work. And all the people that I think are very thoughtful point to the what happened in Spain, which is basically like it completely shut the legals down and all the offshores got volume, which is what's going to happen. There's offshores. It's like a fact we have to live with, and we have to make decisions for the industry with that in mind. Ultimately,
like you're never going to wipe it out. Yeah.
Right. We can't pretend.
People want, it's like, you know, alcohol, what, weed, whatever. Like people want to do it. People want to gamble. People have been gambling since the beginning of time. There's always going to be people that do it in excess. Same with literally everything else. And all you can do as an industry is like make the best decisions possible to try to reduce the harm. Take away instances like the Wall Street Journal piece where there was something that someone could do about it. You're never going to get rid of the problem completely. And hopefully like what Haralabob tweets doesn't actually come to fruition. And, the society can sustain itself even with legal gambling, which I think we will. We've done it with alcohol. We've done it with marijuana. Not that marijuana is bad, but.
Shout out, that's another podcast. Haralabob's tweet was something like, it was something along the fact of all the young men basically like in college spending too much time gambling and whatnot.
Yeah, it was something about, you know, how is this going to become a deeper problem because younger generations are growing up with legal gambling, and maybe, but like gambling wasn't legal when we were growing up and we still got into it too.
Yeah,
so
that's for
there's
sure.
that. It's the argument with alcohol where people say, since it's legal, that means we can teach people younger how to do it responsibly. And so hopefully it goes that direction. And I think it will, because humans are pretty resilient, but, it's good to be cautious.
Yeah, I agree. Now let's talk about Underdog ID Pair, you know, that tweet, which got, it was good for content. Like I got a couple retweet quotes in on it that, you know, I enjoyed making, but you know, it was easy to poke fun at, and maybe we should, or maybe we shouldn't have poked fun at it. If it was an earnest effort, like.
Wait, time out. Do you and your people actually think it's not an earnest effort, or are you just like fucking around? Like, do you actually think they're?
I think it's, I actually side with it's an earnest effort. There's a ton of people who don't think I, so
interesting.
What I would say is, maybe more the new people actually think it's not an earnest effort. Knowing Underdog, I actually think Underdog is, probably one of the only companies with a really solid heart. but you know, and that's as someone who's been limited and what, you know, whatever, like everyone's been limited to Underdog. Okay. That's fine. But, I think people are wary, right? Like if you think about blackjack, there's the Griffin book where, and there's a flyer system where card counters get, you know, flagged between, casinos. Now the Underdog situation is they have a, you know, they want to share information, right, on responsible gaming. And the posts I saw that were probably the most true were like, do you think that DraftKings is going to send over the identity of their biggest whale to FanDuel, you know? And that more rang true to me, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. To preface this, I don't know the Underdog execs personally. I have no insight into this ID. It's ID Pair, right?
Yeah, it's called Guard Dog, and then they're using some
Guard
ID
Dog is the initiative, which I think is a great initiative. I love that they're doing it. I just can't imagine that. Like, Underdog has zero incentive for this not to be an earnest effort. Whether or not we think that this ID Pair strategy is the right one. To your point about like, is DraftKings actually going to share that information? That's another topic. But I think the initiative in general in trying to find this third party solution or third party help in the responsible gambling world is the right thing to do. And I love that they're doing it. And yeah, I can't think of any reason why an executive at Underdog is like in a back room saying, oh, we should do this RG effort because it's going to help us limit more people. Like, there's just no way that conversation's happening. But I understand the concern that if this type of solution is implemented for an RG purpose, once it's already in the door, are people going to then start to use it to limit and share information? I still think the answer is no, because just the way that like the RG team isn't even interacting with the traders, and like it's just a different part of the business. But I get the concern and the conspiracy around
it. Yeah, well, we definitely like a good, you know, the AP community loves a good conspiracy for sure. And you know, it does stem, I think, from blackjack, movies like 21, whatever, you know, where it's not to say like there's people who've had shit times in blackjack and gotten treated terribly, right? But like, generally, I don't think it as much of the casino's effort is spent trying to stop APs as either we think or the movies kind of make it seem. But yeah, my thoughts on it were, of course, I think it's the idea is RG. But the problem is, if every RG initiative, the casino is cutting their bottom line. And if they do an RG, you know, how are they gonna make it make sense? You know, it's such a, I mean, you gave me this quote. It was like, a lot of these executives come in and they act like they're selling sneakers, but you know, they're not, right? So it's like each dollar DraftKings earned is lost by its customers. And that creates such a mindfuck of a business situation, you know, how, and then you're supposed to, you know, create RG programs, but you also have a boss that's yelling at you to get more revenue because he came over from McKinsey and he's always, you know, increased revenue 10%, you know, which is just increasing your customers' losses by 10%, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, how does that work? Yeah.
Yeah. You nailed all of it. And like, I think that's why this should look good upon Underdog, where they're trying to find a outside solution so that there isn't as big of a conflict. But I guess given the fact that they're investing in this company creates kind of that same thought process. But yeah, everyone that's worked with me has heard me say the, you know, we're not selling shoes line, just from being in a bunch of these marketing meetings where it's like very technical speak about why the numbers aren't this and why the numbers aren't that. And it's like a lot of times it's very easy answer. It's like Big Papa Gates went to France for 2 weeks. Like it wasn't like a marketing decision or a product thing. You know, Utacao is like, you know, at some event, and that's why the numbers are down. And so that's where my shoe line started. It was back in the DFS days in customer support. I used to walk around the office and just ramble about stuff. And that was one of them.
And I think it's so spot on though. And it's, you know, it's something the industry is going to have to cope with, as it's now it's big business. It's not just gambling anymore. Like I think, you know, even in the poker days, the people who ran Full Tilt poorly were all poker players. You know, the people who ran Stars, they were very much from within the industry. And now these are publicly traded behemoths, and there's other people involved. And how do we deal with that? And I think what you said about, I'd love to hear about how, like, I think I want to make sure we talk some VIP strategies for sharps, but we save it till the end, right? So it's like they stay till the end. If they make it, then they get like, how does a sharp person max a VIP program? I have my own thoughts. You probably have even better thoughts. But I'd love to hear what your experience is, because when I think of industry, I think trading. Like the trading team largely has to kind of come from the industry. What's what's the conversation like between, you know, how, who does trading talk to? Who's their bosses? You know, who do they answer to? Who don't they talk to? What's that interaction?
Yeah, that it's so fascinating that your mind goes to trading when you think of these digital sports books, because if you work for a digital sports book, you aren't thinking of that at all. I always say that these, you know, I can't speak for every single company, and obviously some of them are legacy casino operators, but a lot of the new companies are closer to Google than they are, the old school Wynn sportsbook or whatever. These are tech companies. So if you work in the industry, you're not thinking of trading. I've never had anyone reach out to me on LinkedIn, a 22-year-old kid, and say, I want to be a trader. They're asking about how I get in partnerships. How do I get in marketing? How do I get into VIP? Can you land me this customer support role? Product, engineering. Like, there are so many different parts of these businesses. There's thousands of employees at these companies. Trading is a very small piece of it. The only people at these companies that even consider trading are probably the execs and then like the customer facing teams, because they're the ones that actually see it. If you're a product person, you probably don't even know how it works. I remember we took a bunch of people to the trading office in Vegas when I was at DraftKings, and it was like a huge shock to most of the people to see that room, you know, that looks like an old school Wall Street room. And it's like, yeah, that group of people is like kind of keeping the lights on, and they have a huge responsibility. As far as the questions, they probably report to different people at each company. Like somebody above them is going to have that override ability at the end of the day if they want to keep a customer on, I assume. Can't say that for certain, but trading is definitely relied on to make those decisions. Like you said, these are people with industry experience. They've been around. So, you know, some McKinsey guy, to use your words, isn't going to stick their neck out to override a guy that's been doing trading for 30 years on a decision. Who do they interact with? That's also probably different at each company. Usually there's some sort of liaison between the customer facing people and the traders who can, you know, speak the language better. So what ends up happening is, you know, you're my VIP. You probably will notice before I do that you're limited. You're going to reach out to me and start bitching and yelling at me.
Yes.
I'm going to then, you know, reach out to this middleman person, unless it's obvious, unless you're doing the, you know, NHL player props stuff or getting crazy CLV on everything, then I'm probably not going to say anything. A less experienced VIP host, probably every time they're going to say, hey, can you tell me why this person's limited, or is there anything else we can do? And so you may get some feedback from trading, or it just may be, you know, the person in the middle saying, you know, fuck off, this guy's obviously sharp. But yeah, like most people at these companies aren't interacting with trading. They're barely even thinking about it. It's very, very niche to our small world.
So crazy. Cause it's like in sharp gambling, Twitter, whatever, it's literally the entire world.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, it's a good lesson to all of us to kind of think outside our bubble, like us as bettors, people who are, you know, execs in these companies. But I'm curious, like, these are, okay, so I've gone through, and this, let's dive into VIP nuts and bolts, how we can stay alive, if we can stay alive, what the life cycle of a client is, the actionable stuff. We want to make some people some money, right? That's best we can do. So let's say, like, we can talk my account example. Like, when I personally was in the VIP program, basically exactly what happened. So I got reached out to, there's a VIP showcase. This is, I'm talking about DraftKings, you know, seemingly it's at first, it's not hard to make it through the showcase. You're just betting a certain amount of money. I'm sure there's some trigger where it's like someone bets X amount. We want to at least consider them as a VIP. And then you get a host that talks to you, get some special offers. And then eventually, you know, the CLV thing was probably why I got kicked. This was early in my career when I was all about CLV. So it probably was a pretty basic toss out. But then I reached out to my host who actually, you know, despite what, you know, sharp Twitter or whatever your engagement with Spank would say, I had a good relationship with. I was very nice we were nice to each other, it only helps. And, you know, we can talk more about that. But, and he said, yeah, like basically like trading, you know, made the decision. They just don't really want to take your bets anymore. It could have even been a little more generic than that, but that was my life cycle. I have a few questions. A, how do you evaluate people to be part of the VIP program? I think that's important information, just so we can maybe sneak a few people into some VIP programs, and then we can go on from
there. Yeah. So the start would be like the VIP team, and outside of trading, you're not overanalyzing the player's profile. It really is at most companies just based on volume. And you know, a variety of other factors is like kind of the line, but it's really
measured over like
everything,
bet size, number, amount bet per week, amount. So there's some kind of combination of, if you like, what's your bet size, how much you bet a week, whatever.
Yeah. I'm sure every single book has their own calculation. But just in general terms, it's going to be volume, whether that's individual bet size, you know, total handle. Like obviously, if there's parlay, if it's right away, if you get flagged in a couple of days, it's going to be because you're betting a ton or you made a big deposit. Over time, if you're betting smaller amounts, maybe the mix of parlays will come into that because they'll have more of a sample size. But I'd say in that first week or so, for you to get flagged without having reached out to a VIP person first is just going to be size. I think we can even take before you make the deposit though. If I were to get the best actionable advice,
let's do it.
I would, if I was sharp, I would try to get in touch with a VIP rep at every single sports book or casino or whatever. And you could do that in any way possible. You could hit them up on LinkedIn. If they've got social media, you can do that. You can reach out to customer support and maybe get connected. And I would explain to them that I'm a massive gambler with credit bookies. I've never played legally. And this is, you know, this is my volume. This is how much I want to deposit. What kind of offers can you give me? And like we talked about, I think 5 years ago, this worked even better because there was that measuring contest. It'll still get you the best offer now though. And so I think, if you can make that connection, you know, don't ask a million questions about price.
What's your favorite sport? Is it Russian hockey? Is it NFL, NBA?
Yeah. They're going to ask you, what's your favorite sport? How much do you bet per game? Like if you can send any bet slips, great. So if you're a sharp bettor and you want a million accounts, I'd recommend getting some great screenshots from some non-sharps credit account. I would like make that connection early and then see what type of offers I could get. And that'll be your best chance at like the biggest deposit bonus. People are, like I said, a bit more wary now, but that still is the best approach before you even make a deposit.
Yeah. So when they ask those questions, so crazy. I was like, just either say you're a VIP. This is what I tell my people. I'm like, say you're a VIP at a couple other places, but you don't want to ruin any relationships. So you'd rather not share. But the offshore is even better. I would probably switch to that now and saying you have no legal gambling presence, because that's a new customer to the market.
Yeah. Yeah. That's valuable. But also like regardless, trading is going to end up making their decision, which has nothing to do with the deposit bonus or that VIP relationship. But that at least will get you in the door. That'll at least get you the best starting point. So those first few days or the first few weeks, you know, you have the biggest balance. And it does give you that chance where if it's close, you might have someone fighting for you. And like it happens very rarely, but there are times when trading is unsure and the VIP rep has a really good relationship with the player. And maybe it's true, maybe it's not. But if they think you are, you know, some big time finance guy at Morgan Stanley with a shit ton of money, they might be more likely to fight for you and say like, this guy's not sharp. He's just a rich dude. And so that's kind of what you would want. And that may give you an extra week or two, but yeah, ultimately trading is going to make the decision. And once they decide it's final, it's most likely final.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever, I'm trying to think. I actually think we had one guy who got unlimited throughout asking at all. I think it was at Prize Picks, but I think they had like switched everything. I don't know how it happened, but he was like limited. Then like he tried one day, he could just bet full size. I was like, okay, let's see where that goes. But besides that, I've never seen it get overturned. So don't yell at your customer support. It's going to happen. But when I've always wondered about this, like if you come in and you're acquired in the VIP program, I mean, I assume trading sees on your account, you're in the VIP program. Is that fair?
If you came through so let's say your account manager finds a new player and they onboard, they bring them on. I don't think at every book that trading would have visibility to that. Okay. I'm sure. I think it would depend on like how they're actually tracking, because if someone comes through VIP program, they're not necessarily automatically in the program. They have just been identified by a VIP rep that they have potential, but you're not like truly in the program until you start playing, or unless you're like 100% bona fide known customer that they can expedite. But 9 times out of 10, you haven't actually hit VIP yet. Trading is going to have their flags regardless. Like there's nothing that you can do to stay out of their, their algorithms or whatever they're looking at.
Yeah, for sure. And if there are, it's going to be with your bet.
Yeah.
Like it's so, and that's something actually we've probably talked about at nauseam, especially with like Mr. Limited. So we don't need to get into it here, but I think it's like, okay, assuming we have the right bet mix, how do we max this now?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like,
So we
get identified by VIP and they're like, hey, this guy could be, this guy could be VIP to trading.
It wouldn't even be to trading. It would just be like, hey, this guy, trading's worried about their own shit. Like this would just be, you reach out to the VIP rep before you even make a deposit. That's your best chance to get the best bonus.
Yeah.
The VIP rep is just going to have you on their list as a potential VIP or however the book decides to track it. And then it's now you're off to the races. And so, at least you have the good bonus. At least you have hopefully a good relationship with the VIP rep so that if your bet mix strategy that you guys know all about works, now you have someone on your side where if it's a close call, they can vouch for you. And hopefully extend your account by some weeks or months.
Right. Okay. So we're going to bucket this then into trading as just they're separate. We're doing different things to try and stay off their bad side. But, go get your deposit bonus. That's going to be through your VIP rep and, try and get, this is where you can try and ask for a big bonus. And I know like it's not consistent. I found it super inconsistent. So like you can, don't be afraid to ask for something big, even if you see that the max they offer is like 1,000 to their VIPs. I mean, you know better than me, but it could be way higher than that.
Yeah, exactly. And you never know who you're talking to, who can actually just make that decision and be like, yeah, I have a good feeling about this guy. I'll give him 50%. Like you just never know. So you might as well try, but don't be a dick. I think I said it before, but yeah, like the VIP reps, especially, are allies to the gambler. Like they don't want to get hit by sharps, but they want people to be playing. And a lot of times it's, when it's really, really obvious that it's someone who's sharp or someone who's bearding, like that can be kind of annoying, but most of the time they're on your side and they're not trying to like find holes in what you're doing.
Right. And my interpretation is like, don't be too worried. Go out, be normal, be nice. Say you're there because you like sports, not because, you just got your new Spank Odds subscription after you graduated from MIT or whatever, and you're trying to earn some money. You know, obvious exactly. stuff. They're not there. They're not going to break into your house and, you know, check out everything you tell them, but just be nice, be normal. After the bonus, I think the deposit bonus is 9 times out of 10 going to be your biggest leverage spot. Sometimes there will be, if you've, I guess, like lost some money, this is what I always say. So my VIP strategy is this, and you can actually, why don't you grade me on this? So you go in, you deposit, you try and get the biggest bonus you can. And then you basically try to lose that money or make it a huge amount. So you just take a really high variance number because, for example, like you might get something like a loss back promotion, which if you lose, you get 15% of your money back or whatnot. That's common, 20% back. That's only valuable if you lose. So losing becomes less bad. So when you have a loss back, you get, it skews the risk reward where you can take on more risk. So basically you try then to either bust your account or make it into a huge, you know, a big number. If you bust, then you ask for more things from the VIP host and you rinse and repeat until you've ran up a huge number that can't be ignored. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I love that. I think you can also add, if you start with that high variance strategy where you're betting big and maybe you lose a little bit, I know that sharps care way more about the money, but you may also get some perks and hospitality that comes with it, which is just an added bonus. So like you may early on have access to the courtside seats or to the event or to the game. And not only is that fun and just free life value for you, but you may meet other VIPs there that could be beneficial. So I think that strategy allows you to take advantage of the hospitality and gifting stuff as well, just because early on they're going to think you're a really good customer, and this will be before trading has made their decision.
Right. And, you know, I've always wondered, the sharps probably only want like loss back or, you know, whatnot. Yeah. And don't go to the games. Go to the games. It's like, go to a game.
Go to the games. 100%.
Like, why not? Pretend you like sports.
Yeah. And it's fun. You'll meet people. I guarantee you that you will like the VIP people that you meet. Well, not guarantee. There's definitely some assholes out there, but like most of the people are good guys, good girls. The team that I hired at DK, I love. Some of them have left already, but it's all really, really good people.
Yeah. Yeah. And then that's basically my thoughts on maxing VIP. High variance. Make sure you're always asking. You know, ask if you lose and you don't ask for something, that's a huge leak. Make sure you do. And, you know, be nice. I mean, another thing that happened, like if you're nice, I remember there was a time where I got a bet void. I don't know if this was in DK or something, but I got a bet that I should have lost voided. And it was some weird situation where like technically the bet should have lost, but I was like, hey, like, do you know what's going on with this? Yada, yada, yada. And it got voided. And that was like a 5 or 6K bet.
Yeah.
That happened. And it should have lost.
It's like any industry. If the airlines want to take care of their top members. So if there's a fringe situation that comes up, if the app goes down, and it'll never happen if like a player breaks their leg, the people that complain about that. But if it's some technical issue, or some geolocation, I guess that's technical. Like that is why having a good relationship with your VIP host matters, because a lot of times they do have the luxury to be like, you know what? I'll give you half your stake back on this one. Whereas if you're an asshole, like it's just human nature not to do that, right? If you're at a restaurant and you're an asshole to the wait staff, you're not going to get the free shots at the end. It's complete common sense that you're more likely to just get on a fringe situation. You're more likely to get a good outcome if you have a good relationship with anyone.
Yeah. No. And what it sounds like, that's like representative of this. It's like, trading ultimately will, if you're just getting tons of CLV or whatever, you're up too much, you're just going to get the axe. But the VIP program, being nice to people, understanding the other areas of the sports book, that's going to help you in fringe situations. You're all, because what are we trying to do as advantage gamblers? We're trying to get that extra 1 or 2%, right? This isn't a guarantee to make sure account's going to last longer, but just like everything else we do, it's like, just tip the scales a little bit more in your favor. This is one way you can do it. There's so many ways outside of just being a good bettor that you can tip the scales. Network, meet people. I mean, there's people at the other end of these companies, right? It's like,
yeah,
it helps to know people. Like, if you know, it doesn't hurt.
A lot of these people are going to go on to do like awesome things in sports and entertainment. I'm telling you, they're not, it's a new world. It's the digital age. The people applying for these roles are like very, very good. They interned at Salesforce and then they, you know, went to business school or whatever. Like these are high value jobs for people that want to get into the tech world. And so people, especially our age, we're kind of still thinking about it like it was 15 years ago, but it's a new world. These people are going to go on to be VPs at the sports teams and leagues and have access and be agents. Why not get to know them? I'm telling you, you'll look back at it's even happening now with like my class from FanDuel customer support. There was a group of like 10 people that came in after me. 7, 8 are now like very impressive people in either gambling or the sports world, like all across the industry. I went to NBA All-Star. I saw half of them, you know,
wow,
working at different companies. And that's going to happen even more because now that was a group of 10 of us. Now there's hundreds of these, you know, kids in their 20s. So yeah, why not have a relationship with them? You'll get some nice perks, maybe get some accounts, and at a minimum, you'll have some more fun in your life.
Have some fun. Why can't it be fun? Why not? Why can't that like being a good bettor be fun? You know, or at least have it be as fun as being a losing bettor. It's like we make it seem so boring. And one of the ways to have it be less boring is to make connections. But I did want to touch on that last thing you said about the jobs in the industry, because it seems to me that that's become kind of a passion for you. A lot of your social media posts are about helping younger people get jobs in the industry. That's seemingly like something that you're going somewhere with?
Yeah, I just think that all the content around gambling right now is advice. And like, I love what you're doing because it's not just the picks and trends, and that was like 100% of the content. Now at least we have this 5% where it's actual people that know what they're doing that are giving advice on how to win and do it responsibly. But still, there's really no content around the business side of things, and especially not for people who want to work in the industry. So this is kind of off the back of, I get hit up all the time on LinkedIn by the same profile of person who tells me they love sports and they're going to work hard. And I always like say similar things to them. So I'm trying to, and I think people get value from it. So to me, I'm part of tweeting and using social media is like, can I get those messages out to a broader group? Give, you know, the kid that's super into sports and business and doesn't want to go work for a team, like show them that there's these more options, there's options out there. And it's not just the operators, it's the different types of businesses around the industry. So you've got geolocation is something I mentioned earlier. Like GeoComply is arguably a better business than the fucking sports books themselves. Like, go work for them.
100%. So
there's all these different businesses, and eventually, you know, Nike, Under Armour, teams and leagues. Like, I bet you all these people will have someone on staff that at least is aware or knows about gambling and how they can tap into the market. So it's a huge opportunity. It's a fun world to be in. This is, you know, these are non-trading jobs that I'm referring to. It's more of that like sports and entertainment atmosphere. And I want to get good people in those roles. I want people that I like. My whole philosophy is like, you know, in 20 years, I'm going to have this beach house, and through work and just my friends in general, I want to invite all these people to the beach house. And if I can land a bunch of people good jobs, they'll be indebted to me for life and probably bring me a nice bottle of wine to the beach house in 20 years.
Dude, I love that. Hey, I can't wait. I hope I can snag an invite.
You're on your way.
And yeah, we're getting there. We're working. And then B, yeah, I agree with you. I've kind of planted my flag in the industry too, like coming, doing more content. You know, I used to, I don't know, just bet, you know, or whatever. I played poker, but I wasn't, you know, I would say involved. Now I feel involved. Like,
has it been fun? Do you feel like it's fun? Has it been fun? Or like, yeah, are you getting like, cause I feel like I'm getting some creative juices out of writing and posting and meeting people's fun. Like, have you felt good about it so far?
Yeah, I've loved it. It's been good for the soul. Like, we met, we wouldn't have met. True. Pretty much any guest on the podcast I wouldn't have met, but more than that, I feel like I have some skin in the game of the industry beyond my personal betting P&L. So it makes me feel connected to like something bigger, like outside myself, which I felt like was such a drag in the early days of my gambling, because I really was just focused on making money at poker. And I had like this existential crisis of like, what am I doing? But now I feel like I've kind of, you know, I'm kind of like, better or worse, I'm in it with this industry. So I want it to do well. And I think a lot of my content or criticisms come from me like loving the industry and not actually like being pessimistic about it, or even thinking it's like inherently a bad industry. But it's more just like, I want the right people in the right positions. You know, whether that's, you know, at a big company like DraftKings, you know, who have outsized say, or if it's, you know, even just getting some more visibility on people on Twitter who are like sharing some thoughtful things, you know, it doesn't necessarily, there's no line to it, but I just think it's changed my outlook, and it's given me, you know, whatever, I guess, purpose, if, you know, that sounds corny or not corny, but it's nice to have outside of just, if I win or lose betting that day, like it's really nice to have something else. And writing is fun. I do agree. You're a good writer. Yeah. I really like your long stuff.
Thanks, man.
Did you always write? Or
no? I've always done like funny Slack messages to my teams, or you know, I'm kind of the vibes guy on Slack. I would send like funny texts and messages to videos to my friends, but I've never done anything publicly. I definitely didn't do well in school, so I don't know. I'm battling. Someone once told me I write too swaggy for corporate America, but.
Oh yeah, shit. Yeah. That's corporate American writing kind of sucks, actually, for like so many reasons. I think like it's not direct enough, so I don't know what it's about half the time. I found that in my corporate America jobs, people were terrible writers. I think people on Twitter are pretty good writers.
Yeah,
generally.
And you get your own style. But I like everything that you said about the content creation, and like you're gonna help people. You're gonna help these young people become better, smarter gamblers. I'm going to help these young people become better, smarter employees of these companies or the companies around the industry. And like all those things elevate the industry. Is there ever going to be a world where sharps are just able to freely run rampant and win tens of millions of dollars a month? No, it's a cat and mouse game, but like there doesn't need to be, in my opinion, a ton of animosity there. It's like, we all know what's happening. There's probably There's a way that you guys can keep earning and making a living without the industry going to shit and without the companies losing all their money. And maybe we can be like a teeny, teeny part of making that possible. But the main thing, like I keep saying, is just, you know, it should be fun. It should be, you know, building good relationships is awesome. And
I well said. I mean, I agree. I think I'm curious to see where we end up in 10 years. You know, I think a lot of like the podcasts I do, I'm like, oh, you know, I'll talk to you next year. And certainly we'll talk many times in between that. But I think this has been more focused on the industry as a whole. And I think the timeframes are much bigger. And I'm really, really curious to see 10 years from now, what this looks like, because I'm optimistic, but certainly like, very smart people like Haral Bob seem to be pessimistic. I think it comes down to finding some, you know, it certainly doesn't come down to like being pissed at each other and, you know, and whatnot and like animosity, but I'd love to see it kind of like find some kind of, you know, Nash equilibrium where like, yes, sharps shouldn't be able to like, this is what I always say about, if there's a, like a program that makes it too easy to win. So like, let's say you're literally doing odds jam, one click bet. You shouldn't be able to do that and make 250 grand a year. Sorry. Like you should like it. Like, and if you think yes, then you're like, that's crazy. Of course, like someone's gonna cut you off from the lowest hanging fruit. But, you know, if you've really invested, you know, time into figuring out, you know, a unique way to win and you're selling this information to other people who are betting and they're making money, I don't know if there's an iteration of the sports betting industry that like completely stops that. And I don't think necessarily it should be. It's not a huge problem because it's hard to do. So I think 100%. Eventually there will be, you know, if you know, there will be some move towards a little bit more difficulty to win, but also maybe some more along with that sustainable habits in the industry that aren't customer acquisition at all costs, at, you know, every advertisement, at every sporting event for DraftKings, et cetera, you know?
Yep. No, that's perfect. I completely agree with you. Some sort of happy medium there. And yeah, I think everyone's aware that the best people in every industry, the smartest people should make the money. And so if you're a winning gambler and you're able to do that, like you said, it's difficult. It keeps getting more difficult, but you should be able to at least earn a living from it. And I think that that's going to happen no matter what. I'm optimistic for one.
I think it's just got to be. It doesn't hurt to be optimistic. That's my other, you know, it's the same thing as it doesn't hurt to be nice to the customer service, right? It doesn't hurt to be optimistic.
I'm with you.
We're the vibes team right here. This is this, what do you call it? Your Slack vibes guy?
I mean, yeah, I'm trying to find my, you know, what exactly I'm going to do in the industry. Chief Vibes Officer, CVO, is a role that I'm very interested in. So if anyone has an opening there, just hit me up.
Definitely unpaid openings at Golden Pants Inc. Cause you know, still doing the free thing. But, yeah, if you want an internship, it's there for you.
Thanks, man. I'll apply.
All right. Well, Dylan, this was a banger. I think this is now the longest podcast that we've recorded. So congratulations on that. I think that, the people will like this. This was really fun. And I always tell sharps that they need to start thinking of putting themselves in the sports book shoes, not just in the trading team shoes. As we've learned from this episode, the trading team is, you know, this minute part of the organization. So just, you know, go back through this, reach out to people who work in marketing or whatever, you know, start making some connections with people at the sports book, understand how they operate, what their incentives are. You know, yeah, it's hard work, but you know, to do this right, it requires some understanding. So I think what you've done is you've helped a lot of people at least start that journey into like understanding how a sports book operates, not just the trading team, that, you know, but everybody, which I think it's going to be really useful for people. So thank you very much for sharing that.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. Keep doing your thing. Your content is amazing. I live in Maryland. I travel a lot. Open invite if anyone wants to shoot hoops, get some shots up. I can't move like I used to because I tore my Achilles, but I use getting shots up as my version of let's grab a drink or let's grab coffee. So if anyone wants
I love that.
You better be able to shoot though if you hit me up.
We said before we started recording, I think I was like, we can't miss a chance to talk about your jump shot because I think it's incorporated in like 80% of your content at this point.
It's, I mean, Have we seen it live?
No,
but I'm going to, once I get to 1,000 followers, I'm going to start posting some videos maybe. And maybe I'll include one, and make some content out of it. Before I tore my Achilles, I would have said that no one in the industry could stay in front of me, but I can't use that anymore. So I have to go to the prettiest jump shot in the industry. That has to be my thing.
Yeah. Just shooting off the rack or something. Well, could you beat Peter Jennings off the rack?
We've never shot together. I have heard rumors that standstill, he's pretty good, but yeah, I'm going to take myself. Are you kidding me?
Okay. Shout out to Peter. Peter's doing that contest against Gilbert Arenas, right?
I think it already happened and he didn't do great, but I do give him some slack because that was like truly off of a rack timed, and people don't realize how hard it is to shoot off a rack, like a 3-point contest. So standstill with a rebounder, I think we'd have a nice, fun battle.
Okay. I love it. Well, hopefully I'm going to link your Twitter here. So we're going to try and push you to 1,000 right at release. And then, we're expecting to see a jump shot, and anytime anyone from gambling Twitter posts something of them doing something athletic, you're just going to get a million comments and, you know, things you're doing wrong. So it'll be really fun for you too.
It'll be
a great experience. Let's all get Dylan to 1,000, demand the jump shot, hopefully day of release that he hits it. And then we'll give him a week after to film a good one and send it.
Yeah. It is getting nice out, so I might even be able to get some in today, put on the contacts and rip some threes. I'll make sure that the video is a minimum like 10 threes in a row, just so you can get a true feel of the form, the footwork.
Yes. The flow from shot to shot.
Yeah, the flow. Like, yeah.
Kind of the athleticism of the movement, not just, you know, not just the 1 3-second clip.
Yeah. And I also, last thing on that, I'm probably going to have some sort of a website called like shootwithme.com or something. That's nice. Okay. If I ever actually get a lot of followers, that would be my way to connect with people. I rented out a gym last year at All-Star Weekend, and I just like reached out to a bunch of people I wanted to meet. Ended up getting this former pro basketball player to come, Jack McClinn, and he brought Francis Tiafo, the tennis player.
Oh, wow.
And it was a whole thing. And so that's my new way to meet people, rent out gyms, go shoot outside. So,
dude, that's cool. It's like you said, let's get a drink, let's get coffee. It's quicker than playing a round of golf.
And you really get to know someone. Yeah. You really get to know someone when you see how they shoot corner threes.
Okay. Okay. Very cool. All right. Well, I'm in on that website.
Yeah.
Where the GP, venture fund. We'll gladly back it. But yeah, thanks again, Dylan. You're the man. This has been awesome. Everybody follow Dylan on Twitter for the reasons we stated, and because he's a great follow. His long form stuff is really, really solid. So yeah, give him a follow. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. And we will see you on the next episode.